Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Two words, everybody: health and care. And where things might go from here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, I believe it is, the 29th of November. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. Our lead today, as I said, is healthcare, specifically the dismantling and reassembling thereof. President-elect Trump, as you know, has nominated Republican Congressman Tom Price to become the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. Representative Price, a physician, it should be noted, a surgeon specifically, has been one of the loudest but also one of the most specific critics of the Affordable Care Act. Congressman Price has, in point of fact, introduced a nearly 250-page replacement plan, a playbook that will come in handy as he tries to re-reform a sector that makes up almost 20% of this American economy. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going with a look at one core principle in Representative Price's proposal, the idea that everybody is going to get a subsidy to buy insurance. Here's Dan.
Conservative health economist Steve Parenti has a challenge.
To get as many people purchasing private insurance coverage as they possibly are financially able to do.
Doing some quick math, Parenti estimates there are about 60 million Americans today who could potentially buy insurance on the individual market if and when Obamacare goes away. Parenti, who has worked closely with congressional Republicans, including Representative Price and Speaker Paul Ryan, says you don't need to be an economist to figure out how to get people to buy in.
We need to keep the premium as low as possible.
There are several ways to do that. One is by encouraging insurers to offer plans with sky-high deductibles, like $20,000 a year. Another is to still offer subsidies like under Obamacare, but change who gets them and how they're calculated. Right now, you get assistance based on your income. The less you earn, the more you get. Above $96,000 for a family of four, you get nothing. Republicans have proposed tying subsidies to age. The older you are, the more you get. And everyone gets it, from the guy living under the bridge to Bill Gates. Health policy researcher Austin Nichols says, here's the trade-off.
You are moving money away from middle-income workers, that's, you know, the bulk of workers in this country, and towards people who are above 400% of poverty.
Parenti says he believes tying insurance to age would lead to more people being insured and save $500 billion in savings over the first 10 years of the plan. Of course, he says it creates a different set of winners and losers. The losers more likely to be sicker and poorer. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Representative Price was only one half of Mr. Trump's health care appointments today. The president-elect also named Seema Verma to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. She is currently the founder and CEO of a health policy consulting firm who has worked with the Indiana state government, home of Vice President-elect Pence, as you know, in rolling out its expansion of Medicaid. That's a health care program for the poor. And given that expansion of that program was a key element of Obamacare, what might the tea leaves tell us about how Medicaid is going to fare nationally in the coming Trump administration? Marketplace's Jed Kim has that.
Seema Verma worked with both Governor Mike Pence and his predecessor in crafting Indiana's Medicaid expansion. It was one of the handful of states to expand Medicaid, but it did it its own way. It brought in health savings accounts and required participants to pay monthly fees, ranging from about $4 to $56. Kosalee Simon teaches public and environmental affairs at Indiana University. She says it's been a success.
Total of about 350,000 individuals enrolled as of January of this year. So enrollment has been very robust.
Susan Jo Thomas is executive director of Covering Kids and Families of Indiana. She says she was initially worried about cost requirements, but
because for most families, the cost sharing provisions are reasonable amounts, they are able to get on the program.
But Indiana's model may not work everywhere. Kavita Patel is with the Brookings Institution.
Certainly, we know from looking nationally that when you require people of low incomes to also pay part of their income for a premium, that there are cases in which they decide not to get the health insurance at all.
Regardless, Verma's appointment may mean more states will feel empowered. Frank Michike is with the National Committee for Quality Assurance.
I think you're likely to see a lot more flexibility for states to do the same type of arrangement.
Which may lead to more states choosing to expand Medicaid, just doing it their way. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders did send the major indices higher. They did it without a whole lot of enthusiasm, though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Some probably not small slice of the political spotlight is going to shift tomorrow from Trump Tower in New York down to Washington, where Democrats in the House of Representatives have a big decision to make. Do they stick with the old guard and reelect Nancy Pelosi as minority leader, or do they turn to somebody new? Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan is challenging Pelosi for the top job in the caucus, and as Democrats try to figure out what went wrong on election night, this whole thing is turning into a question of whether the party needs a major brand overhaul or maybe just some minor retooling. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Washington, D.C. voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. So people here are now wondering, what happened? I hit the streets.
Excuse me.
To ask what they think about the Democratic brand now.
It's a party for the people, higher taxes, things like that.
The Democrats are inclusive for all people, I think. Includes all people.
Right now, I don't know. This whole election thing has made me think a lot.
That was Brian Wood, David Mann, and Daphne Murphy. Wood is a Republican, Mann and Murphy, Democrats. Murphy is doing some serious soul searching. She's a millennial, exactly the kind of person the Democrats need to fire up. But she's not energized. She's anxious about the party.
Is it turning into a party of people who don't actually do anything and just tweet about doing stuff?
Murphy does think the Democratic Party brand is solid. After all, she points out, Clinton won the popular vote. But Murphy says the party needs new leaders who will pay more attention to millennials.
We told you 8 years ago we weren't super into Hillary, and you didn't listen.
Adam Hanft is a brand strategist. He helps companies market their products. Like him or not, Republicans have a strong brand in Donald Trump. Hanft says the Democrats need a personality who can sell their brand.
It's a personality-driven era. We went from Clinton to Obama, and now we need a third 3.0 modern Democrat. It was not John Kerry, and it was not Al Gore.
Hanft doesn't recommend big changes in the Democrats' economic policy positions, but he says Democrats need to repackage them to be more appealing to, yes, millennials, but also blue-collar workers. And that's what Congressman Tim Ryan is arguing he could do if he were elected as the House Democratic leader. He represents Youngstown, Ohio, part of the Rust Belt. He would be a new face at the top, helping define the Democrats' brand. David Caputo teaches political science at Pace University.
Well, so much of a party brand is dependent upon party leadership.
Some House Democrats think with Republican control of the House, Senate, and White House, they're better off with the experienced hand of Nancy Pelosi. But as for the future, Caputo says Democrats need to groom new, younger leaders.
So you start to think, okay, who are the logical candidates for president with the Democrats in 2020? And you're left with not a lot of names.
Caputo says, we don't really know if the Democratic brand needs a major overhaul. We won't know that for a few years. When we find out if Trump's victory signaled a national sea change or was just based on the strength of his personality. If it was a major shift, both parties will have to reevaluate their policies on trade, jobs, and our place in the world. And yes, overhaul their brands. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
A bit more than 6 years ago, April of 2010, the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill sent hundreds of millions of gallons of crude into the Gulf of Mexico and up onto the Gulf Coast. Tourism in a lot of the cities and towns along that coast all but crumbled. And over the years, BP has paid hundreds of millions of dollars to fishermen and shop owners and city governments to set things right. More recently, BP gave Alabama $1 billion to help with that state's recovery. Which is fine, but it's how the money is being spent that has people talking. From Gulf Shores, Alabama, Gigi Duban has that story.
The Florabama in Orange Beach, Alabama, has grown from one iconic beach bar on the Florida-Alabama line to a local franchise that includes a marina, a liquor store, and more restaurants. This is how Chris Sherrill, executive chef at the Florabama, has picked up the pieces. 6 years ago, Sherrill wasn't sure where he'd be today. The BP oil spill hit when he and his wife ran a beach wedding catering business. Images of oil-slicked water circulated around the world, and it wasn't long before the first bride called to cancel. Then more cancellations.
We had returned 14 deposits at $1,000 each, 14,000 cash that was we didn't really have.
Sherrill says he, like a lot of his friends, was devastated.
We lost a car, a house, nearly our marriage. It was tough. It was tough on everyone.
BP started pumping money into marketing campaigns, paying out claims, putting boat owners to work. And over time, people came back to the beaches. But when Alabama lawmakers took the state's latest settlement from BP, $1 billion, and decided to use most of it to help fund Medicaid and pay off state debts,
that was a difficult pill to swallow.
That's Robert Kraft, the mayor of Gulf Shores. He says putting that money into the state's general fund means less money for projects within 25 miles of the coastal zone, as the state had originally planned.
And the projects that we had planned to do, the regional recovery projects, a lot of them are no longer going to be on the table.
Kraft says overall, his city has recovered well. But he's also thinking of some of the hardest hit areas that are still struggling, like nearby Dauphin Island.
Okay, this is the easternmost point of Dauphin Island. We're right on the edge of Mobile Bay, and again, where the Battle of Mobile Bay took place. We're right here next to historic Fort Gaines.
This is Dauphin Island Mayor Jeff Collier. He says there's history here, but ecotourism is the heart of this barrier island's economy. After the oil spill, Collier says, it was a ghost town. There was no fishing, boating, swimming.
So everything that we had to offer people was taken away, and so we were essentially put out of business.
Collier and other mayors and county commissioners serve on the Gulf Coast Recovery Council. They're reviewing all the requests submitted in the region, everything from buying land for more bird habitats to road projects to ease traffic congestion.
Well, there's more than 100, probably pushing a couple of hundred at this point.
He says those requests amount to about $2 billion. But after the state took its cut, the Gulf Coast cities will only get $120 million. This group approving projects is headed by Alabama Governor Robert Bentley, who's been criticized for his use of earlier BP settlements. One example, he spent $1.8 million to renovate a dilapidated governor's beach mansion. He says he'll use it to entertain visitors to boost economic development. Same for using the BP money to pay off state debts and to help fill other budget holes.
In the long run, this was to try to help alleviate some of the problems for the entire state.
As for the Gulf Coast, Bentley says there's already been a lot of money spent there.
I think overall they're doing well.
Paying off debts, he says, benefits the entire state. But folks who live on the Gulf Coast say the hundreds of millions they generate in tourism dollars each year benefit the entire state, too. In Gulf Shores, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So they have people to log the merchandise, style the merchandise, take many different pictures from many different angles.
The photographic art of selling online. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 23 points today, about a 10%, closed at 19,121. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.2%, 5379. The S&P 500 added 2 points, about a 10%, 2204. So we told you about the big changes coming in healthcare. Coming again, we should say, the nation's biggest insurer, UnitedHealth, gained 3.6% today. Aetna up 2.8%. Anthem up 1.4%. The price of olive oil on the commodities market has dropped pretty steadily since a supply shock a couple of years ago. Today, an olive oil trade group sued Dr. Oz. Yes, Dr. Oz, the guy with the TV show. After he claimed large amounts of imported oil is fake, which gets us to this. Grupo de Olio, which makes the brands Bertolli and Carapelli, closed up more than 7.5% today. No, I don't speak Italian. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Raise your hand if you've bought an appliance or a smartphone or some other kind of device at some point recently and been offered an extended warranty or a service plan for it. I'll wait. Yeah, get them up. Way high. Yeah, it's basically all of you. That's what I thought. That is what you call a business opportunity right there. The insurance giant Allstate said this week it's buying a big provider of those warranties, SquareTrade, the company is called, for $1.4 billion, which gives you an idea of just how big the warranty business can be. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
If you want to understand the warranty business, Eric Arnhem is your guy.
It's a lot bigger than you would believe. I'll tell you that.
Arnhem edits the trade publication Warranty Week. He says the industry includes vehicle service contracts, home warranties, electronics and appliance protection plans, mobile phone insurance.
When you add that all up together, just in the U.S., it's over $42 billion paid by consumers for protection plans this year.
SquareTrade entered the scene in 1999 and has a growing slice of the smartphone and electronics warranty market. The company administers plans for retailers like Amazon, Costco, Sam's Club, and Target. Allstate has been struggling to grow. It sells car and homeowners insurance, mostly through its network of agents. Analyst Brett Horn with Morningstar says more customers are buying insurance directly online.
They're a leading player in a mature industry, and they're in a channel that the industry is shifting away from a bit. So the top line growth has been hard for them to achieve.
According to Allstate, SquareTrade's revenue has grown fourfold in the last 5 years. It's not clear how profitable it is, though. SquareTrade is privately held by a group of shareholders, including Bain Capital. Warranty Week's Eric Arnhem says consumers can pay up to 50% of the purchase price for a protection plan, so there's plenty of money to be made on a buyer's peace of mind. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Sometimes, though, stuff just wears out because of normal use, not a thing usually covered by warranties. And sometimes that stuff is really big. Millions and millions of mattresses and box springs are thrown out in this country every single year, both the sheer number of them and their bulk, creating expensive challenges for waste managers. So some states are looking to have consumers share more of that cost. Independent producer Brita Green has that one.
I'm standing on the warehouse floor at Goodwill Industries in Duluth, Minnesota. Mattresses and box springs are piled almost 20 high along the walls and walkways, like towering layer cakes of florals and pastels. Workers hustle through the maze. Ultimately, they'll take each of these mattresses apart, layer by layer. They strip the fabric and foam by hand and use a machine to peel the spring cages from their wooden frames. Greg Conkins is the facility's operations director. He lists off the resale value for the mattress parts, starting with the cotton.
We are getting 4 cents a pound. With the quilted toppers, we are receiving 3 cents a pound. The foam is at a current rate of 10 cents a pound, and that has been at that rate for probably 8 years.
This recycling process is time-consuming and expensive, and you're not going to get rich doing it. But it's increasingly desirable to waste managers. They want to avoid sending mattresses and box springs to landfills. That's because these things take up a lot of space, and they're hard to keep buried under the surface. They tend to rise like marshmallows to the top over time. The most valuable piece for resale is the steel coils, the spring cages. But foundries often won't accept them in their existing form. Conkin says they have to be much more compact.
Because it's like shipping air when it's not compressed.
At first, this Duluth facility had no way around this problem. But then it worked with local researchers and engineers to build a specialized machine to crush the springs. For Conkins, that machine made all the difference financially.
I'm going to use the word godsend because if we didn't have it, we would not be producing a recycling of mattress program. We wouldn't be able to be in the business.
He now recovers about $2 per mattress, and most of that comes from the steel. Back on the warehouse floor, a worker loads several spring cages into the machine to be crushed. Under the roar, you can hear the metal snapping and breaking. And then, miraculously, out comes a compact brick of steel. The machine's inventor, Clint DeRoss, looks on. I ask him how much these bricks weigh.
Depending on this, how many mattress springs, but they should be somewhere between 80 and 100 pounds per bale.
They kind of look like you could just pick them up.
Yeah. Go ahead and try.
Yeah. Still, Goodwill Industries has to charge a fee for every mattress or box spring it accepts to keep its program viable. Three states recently started asking consumers to pay this expense up front. Now, in Connecticut, California, and Rhode Island, anyone buying a mattress or box spring pays about $10 extra. That money goes to funding recycling programs, offsetting the cost of infrastructure and labor. Here in Minnesota, waste officials are watching those programs and may move to follow their example. In Duluth, I'm Brita Green for Marketplace.
You can file this next one under, I didn't know it worked like that. We're all basically familiar with shopping online, right? Specifically with the pictures on this website or that help you figure out what it is that you're buying. We're going to talk high-end goods here for a second because it turns out that if you buy luxury stuff online, you're probably buying it through a very specific middleman, a company called Farfetch, which helps smaller boutiques with that whole selling online thing. Elizabeth Holmes wrote about Farfetch for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kai.
So tell me about this company, Farfetch, it's called?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in e-commerce and how people shop online, and pictures are a really important part of that. And when I heard what Farfetch was doing, I thought it was really interesting because Farfetch is an online marketplace. And to put together a web page that looks consistent and uniform and attractive and convinces you to spend hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, is actually a lot of work. And what they've come up with, instead of relying on photos from the boutiques or even the brands themselves, they shoot all their product at one of four photo studios around the world.
All right. So if I own in my other life a designer boutique here in Los Angeles, how does it work? What do I have to do?
It would be a fabulous boutique.
You don't even know how fabulous. That's a whole different thing.
I think it would be great. What you would have to do is send the merchandise that you want to sell on Farfetch. You would have to ship it to one of their photo studios. The one here in North America is in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And then from there, this sort of massive visual pit crew takes over. And so they have people to log the merchandise, style the merchandise, take many different pictures from many different angles, make sure that it's really professional and attractive, and then they ship it back to you.
And also, when you get into this in the piece, it is remarkably assembly line-like, this whole process that Farfetch goes through once it gets the goods in the door.
I was sort of surprised by that, too, because a model will wear a piece of clothing for, the goal is less than 4 minutes.
Wow.
If they have two models, you know, alternating, it's 2.5 minutes, which is just kind of crazy. And so this team is not given much time to do much with them, but they need those consistent photos from those specific angles to convince shoppers, hey, it's worth, you know, shelling out lots of money to buy this beautiful dress.
Yeah, well, but here's the thing, though. I mean, what is it that makes a good picture for a luxury item? Because if you go on Farfetch, you're like, yeah, okay, that's a fine shot, whatever, you know, but it's no like Annie Leibovitz.
No, but if you look at something like eBay or even parts of Amazon, and you look at their sort of hodgepodge of photos, yeah, it's really hard sometimes to discern what you're buying. And that might not matter if you're only spending $20. But if you're spending $200 or $2,000, it matters a lot. And so to be able to compare one leather moto jacket to another, and you have the same angles and the same sort of look and feel to the shot, then it seems like a truer comparison of standing in a store and holding two items side by side.
Let's get back to my soon-to-be boutique here in Los Angeles.
Fabulous Kairos
boutique. That's right. How does it work monetarily? Do they get a cut? Does the website redirect from their site to my site? I mean, what are the you know, logistics there?
They get a pretty sizable cut. Yeah. And the boutique owners that I talked to said that that cut is better for them to sort of take that hit than try and run a website themselves. Hmm. A lot of these boutiques are small and they serve a very specific local clientele. And what this does is it gives them a worldwide audience. And, it, you know, it doesn't sound like it would be that much work to operate a website, but when you think about the logistics of shipping everywhere and keeping track of customers and things like that, they're very happy to outsource that to Farfetch and get a new audience in the process.
Elizabeth Holmes writes on fashion for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Trump administration gets a friend from Wall Street. There are late reports this afternoon, lots of them, that the president-elect has chosen former Goldman Sachs partner Steve Mnuchin to be his new Treasury Secretary. The formal announcement is set to come tomorrow. Mr. Mnuchin was the Trump campaign's national finance chairman. That's about the extent of his political experience. He's run a hedge fund. He's bankrolled a couple of big-budget movies as well. Bloomberg did a big cover story on him a couple of months ago. We've got my interview about that piece on Steve Mnuchin at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 23 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, a 10% there as well. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.